Welcome, everyone. Addiction can affect just about anyone, regardless of their income, education, job. And in recent years, addiction has become more prevalent among professionals in the medical, legal, and other high-pressure fields. My guest today, Dr. Joe DeSanto, is the medical director of Hotel California by the Sea Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center in Newport Beach, California, and he's the host of The Recovery Show on KOCI 101.5 FM. Dr. DeSanto has been a firsthand witness to this recent increase in addiction among professionals. He's here today to talk to us about their unique treatment and support needs, why addiction rates are climbing, and how to recognize red flags if you're concerned about someone in your life. Dr. Joe DeSanto, welcome to the show. I'm so honored and excited to have you with me today.
Hi, Erica. The honor is mine.
Well, thank you. And I just, you know, let everyone know I was on your radio show recently, and I think we had such an interesting and insightful discussion about recovery in a totally different context. But today I do want to first start talking about the addiction issue among professionals nowadays and how it's something that I think is not talked about as much because of the stigma that maybe that creates.
It does. And there's a, you know, addiction is a shame and guilt-based disease. It lives in shame and guilt. And when you're a professional, especially a doctor, say wearing a white coat, you're more prone to that, and you're less likely to seek help, for sure.
Right, because people are coming to you with the most, you know, with their most kind of feared ailments, things that, you know, they can't figure out on their own, things that are physically going on. And it's kind of like, even when I was a little girl, I always saw my doctor as somebody that, you know, can do no wrong in a sense.
Right. You know, growing up in the 60s, 70s and 80s, you know, doctors were held as almost godlike figures, you know, some of that still remains. And, you know, it's a shame to say doctors pretty much are, you know, can have humongous egos. Now, you take a doctor now that develops an addiction and needs help, and we're way less likely because we're the ones always dispensing the help, and people are relying on us and kind of holding us on this pedestal. So it's really, really difficult for us to come down from that pedestal and admit we have a problem, number one, which is the most difficult thing. And sometimes we're in such denial that we don't even recognize it in ourselves, as, you know, you see with, it's pretty common with addicts and alcoholics to be in that kind of denial.
Right.
And then to actually,
go on, please.
And then to actually know where to find help, because if you're not in the field of addiction, you're typically not well-trained. As at least as an American Western trained doctor, you're not well trained to know what's available for treatment and where to seek help.
Yeah, and can we just talk too about the high level of stress that maybe is endured in these kind of positions where there's high trauma, there's stress, there's always, you know, someone's life's in your hands. It's a little bit, you know, different than other professions, but are doctors trained in this, like how to deal with these kinds of traumas that they see, or, you know, these losses, or even just the emotional pain that you endure by watching somebody go through, you know, kind of cancer or whatever it is that they're dealing with? Do they get trained emotionally? Is there any psychological component that needs to be taught to doctors?
Well, you know what, it's pretty funny. Counselors like yourself, psychologists, psychiatrists, they are actually mandated to receive, it's called supervision, but counseling once a week to kind of de-stress and process the grief and the trauma that they've gone through for the week. And, you know, doctors have to, you know, we experience death, we experience, you know, grief, and we're not typically not supposed to show emotion during this time. So where does that go? We suppress it, we bury it, and it's got to be relieved somehow. And if you're in the unlucky 8 to 10%, and you've come across a substance or alcohol and you really like that, and it becomes your coping mechanism, it's typically doesn't end well.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen for whatever reason in the past couple of years, I've seen a lot of nurses entering treatment. And I don't know, you know, a lot of them, I think, work crazy hours. Their shifts are all over the place. Their sleep is not regulated. They don't get adequate amount of nutrition because they're inside all day. It's vending machines. And, you know, and I think it's quite rare to hear about it because, you know, most people don't discuss these things. It's something that's kind of kept hush hush. So have you noticed that with nurses as well?
I've noticed that with nurses, with dentists, with anybody in the health profession. We're the people that supposedly profess health to everyone, but we're the last people to tend to self-care. Self-care is so missing in the professional world, especially the professionals that I see that come in with addictions, really to anything. Mm-hmm. We've lost the sense of wanting to take care of ourselves. And you know, now that I've been 4 years sober, that does not make sense to me. You know, I mm-hmm. can't go a day without taking care of myself. But I'll tell you, back in the day, you know, before I became board certified in addiction medicine, I was an ER doctor and I worked in urgent care. And I worked typically night shifts. And let me tell you, if you're prone to addiction and you're working night shifts, you're bound to have something bad happen to you.
Yeah, I would think so. It sounds like a little bit of a setup of just, you know, learning how to cope or deal with something negative. So can we talk just a little bit about, I mean, maybe since you've already shared that you have, you know, been sober now for yourself for 4 years, congratulations with that. Any tips
Thank
or
you.
Tools about if somebody out there right now is, you know, in one of these professions or just in general, you know, dealing with a dependency or an addiction issue, what's the first thing that we can do to help them in terms of taking a look at themselves, where they need a little bit more self-care? And like you said, now you don't even think about it because you've created a routine for yourself, which has been probably life-saving.
Yeah, I have to stay sober every day. I mean, to live the best life possible, you know, to reconnect to the life that I created for myself, but I didn't want to show up to. It doesn't make any sense now. Well, addiction is insanity when you look at it from the outside. So typically when a doctor or any professional becomes addicted, they typically become dependent first. And that was my story. You know, I had used alcohol, did drugs recreationally up until the point where I hurt myself. I was a weekend warrior kind of athlete, and I used to do kickboxing. So during doing a sidekick, I always wanted to be the best in the class. So doing a high sidekick, I dislocated my hip joint on the hip that was on the floor, and I tore my hamstring off the bone.
I don't know
if you've ever had that experience, but it's quite no. painful. And I was given large amounts of oxycodone. Mm. And after I had found opiates, it kind of gave me what I was looking for in life. It reduced anxiety. It allowed me to work harder. It allowed me to work longer hours, and night shifts seem to go by really fast. So why wouldn't I continue to keep using them? You know, and I started using them even when I didn't have pain. And then I became dependent on them, and then I became addicted to them.
Yep.
And and the following years were a living hell.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As you probably know when you talk to your clients. So typically when a professional develops an addiction, they're the last ones to even know they've got it. So it's typically they either get caught doing something illegally or they're found out by one of their colleagues.
Right. And do you mind disclosing what happened to you, or how did you create the turning point to actually help yourself or get help or ask for help?
Well, I wouldn't have been able to talk about this 3 years ago or 4 years ago, but you know, I was caught with my hand in the cookie jar.
Uh-huh.
And let me tell you, when a doctor comes in for treatment, the main thing that they're worried about is not their sobriety, it's their license and whether they're going to lose it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw treatment immediately.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had developed a cycle of addiction to opiates that just was never ending. I'd wake up, have to take them several times during the day, have to take them before I went to sleep, I'd have to take them. Yeah. And if you don't have them, you go into withdrawal, severe withdrawal.
Right. And it's very dangerous. And it's very, you know, and it's the physical addiction. I don't know whether people understand this or not, but it's like you said, it's, you know, you're, it's attaching to your tissues and your body's screaming for it if you don't feed it.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, right. So
it's a living hell and it's a dark. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's a living hell and it's a darkness that if you haven't experienced, and I know you have your own story too, if you haven't experienced that darkness, you have no idea what it feels like. And and the final night, the night that I stopped using, I tried to kill myself and it didn't work.
Wow.
And if you can't get that right, you really don't have any other options.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
The following morning I saw treatment. That was April 10th, 2012. And I haven't looked back since.
Well, I'm so proud of you. Congratulations on that. And really, it takes a lot of courage to share that kind of story with everybody. So I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing your truth with everyone, because I know that it helps people out there and it helps people, you know, share their story. And I think when you lean into your story, you speak your truth, it's really not as bad as it sounds. And there are all of us out there have experienced that darkness to a certain degree. And, you know, when I was getting sober too, I didn't think anybody would understand. I thought I was the only person that was kind of living this way, but little did I know
right.
that there's millions of us. Yeah,
exactly. And when you're an addicted professional, a lawyer, anybody who's a licensed professional, a policeman, a priest, I'm taking care of every walk of life now with addictions. Mm-hmm. The main thing is that you worry about is that you're the only one that's going through it. When I went into rehab for the first time, well, for the only time, I should say, you know, the doctor that took care of me, if he didn't put his arm around me and tell him it's okay, I went through the same thing, I don't know if I would have made it through. But just to hear that another professional had gone mm-hmm. through the same thing that I was about to go through, it was night and day difference. And I put my nose to the grindstone and I worked a program, and 4 years later, I'm a medical director of a really amazing treatment center and the co-host of a FM radio show. Does that make sense?
That's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about both of those things in one second. I just wanted to just say one last thing about, you know, anybody that's out there that is a licensed professional or anybody out there that really is thinking about getting help. I want them to understand that there are programs out there. And I know this, you know, to a degree, but I think you could shed some more light on this, that will allow you to keep your license if you go through protocol. Correct? Like if you go to treatment and you complete a certain amount of time, there's a way for you not to lose your license. Right?
I mean, unless you've done something completely egregious, the medical board is completely, especially in the state of California, the medical board is completely understanding. And if the medical board is listening, thank you so much for giving me my life back, first of all. Second of all, yes, they want you to admit, take responsibility. And especially if it's apparent that you've got an addiction or if you're an alcoholic, to really own that. You know, the medical board, you know, they require their pound of flesh, but they also want to make sure that their job is to protect the public. And they want to make sure that the doctor is not going to A, relapse, and B, hurt somebody. Typically both in the same, in the same fell swoop, unfortunately. And they're very understanding if you, maintain your sobriety, and they typically check if a doctor is a known addict or alcoholic. Their license is typically put on probation for 3 to 7 years, and they have to test randomly body fluids, typically urine, just to ensure that they're sober. But you usually get to keep your license. Like I said, unless you've done something, that's understandably unforgivable.
Right. Well, thank
you. Luckily, that wasn't me.
Yeah. And I know other doctors and nurses and professionals that have gotten help and did wind up keeping their license. So I just want anybody out there that's sometimes not confronting this or is in a grave state of denial because they don't want to lose their license, that they get help. And I don't want that to be the case. So I want people to hear us today and understand that they can get help. They won't most likely lose their license. And of course it's individual. It's every individual is different, but thank you for shedding some light on that.
And if I could say something, professionals, especially doctors, have twice the addiction rate as the general public just because they're easy access to medications, the stress, like we talked about, and the inability to let that stress off. And unfortunately, the suicide rates are almost quadruple the typical suicide rate in the general public. So it's really sad when you hear about a doctor taking his own life, but it's way more common than you think.
Yeah, I would think.
And it doesn't have to come to that.
Yeah, of course not. Of course not. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And let's talk about, Hotel California by the Sea, the Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center, where you are the medical director. And tell us a little bit about what you guys do there.
Well, we started out as a men's only program, men's professional program, and that's thriving to this day. Mm-hmm. We take care of licensed professionals in an anonymous setting. I supervise the medical care from all the way from detox to outpatient care. And Hotel California by the Sea offers full detox services for any drug in safe, monitored setting. And then they have a fantastic residential program for adult males. Their houses are on the beach. I wish I had a place like this when I was getting sober.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately. Fortunately, I had a beautiful program down at Mission Hospital in Laguna Beach. Uh-huh. I have to mention them because they saved my life as well.
Right, and it worked for you. But this sounds wonderful. So this is an all men's program.
It started as an all men ML program, adult uh-huh. only, and it's expanded to women, and we have a young people's program as well, handle adolescents to early adulthood.
Oh wow! So you guys are doing it all now.
We're doing it all, and they've grown significantly. In the 2.5 years that they've been open, they went from 12 a 12-bed facility to, I believe they have over 100 beds now.
Wow, that's incredible.
And they're doing really good work with integrity. And as you know, that's so uncommon in our field, especially lately.
Right. Well, and that's why I absolutely am grateful to be connecting to people like you who work with a sense of integrity and authenticity and have walked a path and can lead people and can really relate and have the empathy that I always think is so important when people are trying to start this process of recovery. And let's talk about your fantastic radio show just for a moment and tell everybody where they could listen and find you. I know it's an FM show, which is amazing, just because I still adore, like, you know, the real radio. I think it's just amazing still to get in the car and listen.
You know, I've always wanted to be on the radio, and I never thought it was going to be on a talk show. You know, when growing up, I was in college, I had a radio show. But ever since the day I got sober, I said, you know what? From what I know and what I've gone through, I need to reach as many people as possible. I'm not saying this, you know, smarmily. I wanted to reach as many people as possible because not that many people have had the experience that I've had to be board certified in addiction medicine, to be able to speak to an empty room for 2 hours. I mean, I don't know a lot of people that can do that, and to have my own story, you know, that I can relate with the people that are calling in and asking questions. So every Thursday night, we do have an FM radio show, which is going by the wayside, like terrestrial radio. How many, how many shows do you know that are on FM radio? Typically everybody's podcast.
Absolutely.
Or live interneting.
Right.
So I think that was pretty unique. And I went to the station manager and we're on a 24th show, and every Thursday night from 8 to 10 PM Pacific time, we're on 101.5 FM, KOCI, and if you're not in Orange County, you can listen to kociradio.com.
Uh-huh.
And it's a show about treatment, about addiction, about human connection, and our topics range from the night that you were on, we talked about your book, Rewired. Last night, we had two chiropractors on talking about, what your body goes through when you're going through detox, and how you can supplement with IV amino acids and minerals. It was really interesting. And next week we're doing a topic on eating disorders.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, as you're talking about this, because there's so many different topics at hand with just to stick to the professional thing for a moment, or just anybody that is an adult that is taking some kind of, I guess ADHD, ADD medication. I just have been hearing this a lot lately, that there's a lot of people in professions, all different kinds of professions, whether you're a stockbroker, you're, you know, an advertising exec, whatever it is. I keep hearing this, that more and more adults are getting prescribed Ritalin or Adderall to perform better, to concentrate better. What do you think of this? Have you been hearing this a lot since you have a show on this? And obviously, are in this field?
Absolutely. You know, what do I think of it? I think it's great.
What's going
on? Great for business. It's great for business, I'll tell you that. What I'm concerned about, you know, more and more adults, but, you know, they have control over what goes into their body. What I'm really concerned about, and I did a story on this two shows ago, is that there's Adderall in gummy chews now, which has been approved by the FDA for five-year-olds. You can go as early as 5 years old.
That's crazy.
Diagnose ADHD in a five-year-old, I don't know. You know, I'm just going to go on the record. I'm not a psychiatrist. But from what I've seen, typically ADHD is overdiagnosed. And stimulant, ADHD medications are overprescribed. But unfortunately, you know, kids don't come across it prescribed by their doctor. They're brought in by friends. Sometimes they even get it from their parents. Mm-hmm. And their use will start pretty innocently to get better, quote unquote, get better grades, to stay awake, to study. And then it becomes a party drug. And then it goes from, casual use to habitual use to addictive use, compulsive use.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they're adults, you know, what I do see frequently is... our middle-aged female patients who are trying to lose weight. Mm-hmm. They get started on amphetamine-based diet pills, and then they progress from, you know, that to Adderall, to Vyvanse, which are prescription amphetamine drugs for ADHD. And then they move on to methamphetamine, which is way more serious.
Right. Absolutely. But for these adults too, I mean, it really is speed, you know, like that's what I keep, you know, and I really do have some strong opinions about that. You know, even if you are somewhat, if you're quote unquote ADD, it supposedly doesn't affect you in that speedy way, but it still does affect your nervous system that way, because those are essentially the compounds, right? You can't change the compounds.
Oh, it's speed. If you're taking Adderall, you know, don't be confused. You're taking speed. In fact, you're probably
taking
way purer a version of speed than if you were to find it on the street.
And
it's prescribed by a doctor, so it's okay for you.
Right. Yeah. And I'm just hoping that people, you know, really, especially as you get into adulthood and you haven't developed maybe an addiction quite yet in your life or dependency on something, like this would be the last thing that you really want to have to deal with. Especially if it's just something about functionality and you just think you're going to work a little harder, you know what? Sleep more, exercise better. I don't know, do something else. But, you know, to get yourself and your nervous system kind of addicted to this drug is really, I think, creating a nightmare. I'm seeing this a lot with professionals. So that's just another thing.
Yeah.
Keeps coming up.
I am too. And how do you feel about somebody who comes in that amphetamines or stimulants are not their drug of choice? They've never really gotten into cocaine, but now they're, you know, or they come in with, say, with an opiate addiction, or they're a pure alcoholic, but they come in on Vyvanse for their ADHD. How do you look at that? I mean, I am firmly based in abstinence-based treatment, and I know that that's not in fashion. And I know that's what the government wants us to do, is to kind of accelerate medication-assisted therapy or treatment. And sometimes stimulant medication to treat ADHD is part of that, part of the quote-unquote harm reduction. How do you feel about that?
I'm with you. I'm abstinent-based. I mean, that's my belief, especially if you are... literally trying to clear your mind, your body, your spirit, get back to some kind of balance. I think it would be so dysregulating to your system to still have you on any kind of drug. So for me, my belief is when you're getting sober to really, you know, get off everything, obviously with the help of a doctor to wean you off whatever it is that you are on. Of course, I don't tell anybody just to stop, but yeah, I absolutely encourage that. I mean, you know what? Go through treatment for 90 days, then tell me what you feel after that, and then we could re-explore.
Right, exactly. Give your brain, if anybody's listening out there,
give your body a break,
rest for a second.
Right.
And typically people who we see have had a lot of trauma, whether it's sexual, physical. And
right.
I don't care what you say. You do not do the same trauma work you do completely sober as you do if you're on a mind-altering substance. You can't connect with that trauma. You cannot process it properly.
Rarely I
see a person, excel when they're on Suboxone, mm-hmm. when they're on Vyvanse. You know, it's just,
it's almost like a
suit of emotional armor or kind of like a marshmallow suit where you really don't care what you've been through. And if you don't care about what you've been through and you don't process it properly or change it, you're bound to repeat it. And that's what happens with relapses.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Joe DeSanto. It's been such a pleasure to have you on. You could find Joe at DeSantoClinics.com and HotelCaliforniaByTheSea.com. And it's been such a pleasure to have you on. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us and stay well.